Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we are seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith. I'm Kent.
I'm drinking coffee.
That's Nathan over there drinking coffee. We're in our series on John, and today we're going to talk about the role of Israel as a nation in the salvation of the world. Now, we're going to look at that theme in the Gospel of John.
Right.
Israel's role in God's plan.
Yep. Oh, it's good. Good stuff.
Where do you see that in the Gospel of John, Nathan?
Oh, see,
I think
of places.
Like the Jews are like the bad guys in the Gospel of John.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And it's problematic because he refers to them as the Jews, you know. Uh-huh. And in other ones, he'll refer to them as, you know, the authors will refer to them as the Pharisees or something, you know, party of the Jews. But in John, he just kind of shortens it to just the Jews.
Yeah.
So he doesn't, if you read more recent translations, they're kind of, they find ways, either there's a footnote that says, hey, this doesn't mean everybody's of this race or whatever.
Yeah.
It sounds pretty anti-Semitic.
Uh-huh.
And I guess throughout
people,
history.
People have seen it. People, yeah, there's been it's been seen as a source of anti-Semitism in history. I mean, sometimes he refers to the Pharisees or the leaders of the Jews, and certainly there are Jews in the Gospel of John who are, quote-unquote, the good guys, you know,
mm-hmm.
who are coming to Jesus and loving Jesus, repenting of their sins and following Jesus. But it is common for John to say, just refer to the Jews with reference to that
right.
group of people who are opposing
right.
Jesus and his disciples.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's problematic. But anyway, yeah. I guess I would contend, and I haven't researched this enough to, I just really, you know, come down hard on it, but he seems to make a distinction between Israelites and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like John is doing away with the religious history of this people and really even their connection to Abraham or their veneration of Abraham. He's differentiating Jesus from Moses to some degree, and really showing that Jesus is superior to Moses. And at the same time, as I was going through just some preliminary notes on this, that you can't escape the Old Testament references in John, the mm-hmm. allusions, and mm-hmm. you know, there are things that are not explicit, like we talked about last time, Isaiah 55, mm-hmm. how that runs behind the book,
mm-hmm.
you know, how Jesus is the Word of God who comes forth and returns, right? So clearly, the book of John is leaning heavily on the Old Testament. We talked about how Jesus says that the, you know, the scriptures point to him. They're a witness to him.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an interesting relationship, I think, between Judaism and this new thing. You know, we call mm-hmm. it Christianity, but sometimes that's deceiving because it sounds like there's another religion that kind of butted mm-hmm. off of Judaism and then kind of sprouted and became its own
mm-hmm. unique. Whereas, thing. Like the writer of the Gospel's perspective is that this is the culmination of Judaism. This
right.
is the thing that all the scriptures and all the experiences were pointing toward.
Right, and the continuation of it. It's not like it's Judaism fulfilled its role, you know, the history with Israel fulfilled its purpose and then fell away. I mean, I've used the analogy of a rocket, kind of a stage is falling off, but there's continuity in that the purpose is getting to the moon. And so the purpose uh-huh. of each stage of the rocket, you know, in those old school Apollo missions, uh-huh. Is unified with that of the landing module.
Okay.
Right? That there's a continuity there, whereas certain elements of Judaism, the more ritual things, have fallen off, the purpose remains the same. And so, you know, that the gospel was always there. It's not like it's come to replace. It's not like the space shuttle to the Apollo rockets. Mm-hmm. Whereas the space shuttle is the refinement, fulfillment of what the Apollo rockets were, or, you know, even SpaceX is yet the further evolution, right?
Uh-huh. So, yeah.
You know, someone would say, well, you know, you had the Apollo missions and then you had the space shuttles and now you have, you know, Falcon 9 or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
That would be like the view of a lot of people who see the relationship between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. You know, that they're all iterations of the same thing with improvements over time.
Okay.
That's just the way we do things. It's the way we see things. And it's an overlay that we tend to put on world religions.
Yeah.
So, and then someone would counter and say, but, you know, with the religion, you're dealing with God. Obviously, there's not improvements over time.
Uh-huh.
You know, that the more ancient, the better, right? And so that's, you know, this counter argument that I guess could be made. And that so.
Not two different rockets.
Right.
Same rocket.
Yes. Yeah.
Different stages in the rocket.
Yeah.
Unified.
Unified.
One mission.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's not even dispensations, you know, it wouldn't be dispensationalism in that there are these eras where one thing is getting done and, you know,
uh-huh.
but that it's all part of the same thing.
Right.
That the gospel is this eternal purpose. It's there from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
Whereas dispensationalism would say, well, there was a purpose in this phase and God dealt with people in this phase. And then there was a purpose in that phase and God dealt with them in that phase,
uh-huh.
you know, and that there's some pivoting, you yeah. know, whether real or apparent, that would be a dispensationalist mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what my understanding is that there is a continuous movement, growth, and yes, fulfillment in Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all him,
uh-huh.
you know, it's him. In the Garden of Eden, it's him with Abraham. It's him at Mount Sinai. You know that,
uh-huh.
that he's the continuity between it all. That Christ, this the Word, which as John, back to John, you know he draws that line for us. In the beginning was the Word.
Yeah.
So John's not saying, "Hey, I'm talking about a new character that's come on the scene." You know, mm-hmm. it's not like that was the era of the judges and this is the era of the kings. You know, whereas you have something that's quite disparate and a change,
mm-hmm.
right? But you have the era of Christ throughout, but with humankind needing a different approach or whatever, you know, that the kind of the movement of humankind toward Christ is Paul uses a childhood metaphor,
mm-hmm.
right? So child and the adult are the same person. Right. And that the childhood was largely to develop the adult,
mm-hmm.
you know, that the adult is largely the product of the childhood. Right.
Yeah. It's a good illustration.
Yeah.
So in John 1, John says that the law was given through Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And there's, I think, never ending debate over whether that's contrast or comparison.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I go back and forth on it and I've read about it recently and I forgot what I read about it recently, but
mm-hmm.
you know, I struggle with it.
Yeah.
It reads like contrast.
Uh-huh.
At least in English.
Mm-hmm.
It's like now there was law, but now finally there's grace and truth.
Yeah.
But I think it could be that I'm reading something into law that Paul, the John, the writer, doesn't mean for me to read.
Yeah.
Clearly he's saying this full revelation of God is now present in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm asking you, how do you see that?
Yeah.
Do you see it as there's, both. Well, grace yeah. upon grace. See, we're in that yeah. context, he says, we've all received grace upon grace. And then mm-hmm. I think he then says, the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So
right.
grace upon grace could be gospel upon law. Like the law was grace. God gave the law through Moses, and that was grace.
Yeah.
And then God gave grace through Jesus, more grace, a fuller mm-hmm. grace through Jesus Christ. So there it's like progression.
Yeah.
But I can also see it as contrast.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. I think, I mean, that's just, it's such a pregnant verse.
Yeah.
You know, that it maybe we could even spend a whole episode unpacking it. But, and the word, you know, when you say grace upon grace, the word is problematic, I think, to our thinking. The word upon is not the normal preposition, but it has to do with instead of or in place of an exchange. So it's not like there's a layer of grace and then grace, another layer is laid on top of it, but that one grace is being accepted and the other is being given. Mm-hmm. You know, one is being moved out of the way and the other is being put in its place, right? Mm-hmm. So there's an exchange going on, which I guess would be more of a contrast, mm-hmm. in the sense that, you know, it's not like Judaism is great and then if you have Christianity, it's the icing. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be, you know, cake would be grace and icing would be grace upon grace. Mm-hmm. But it's instead, you know, you've got a muffin and I give you a, you know, a pie. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a dessert, you like it, you're happy with it, but it's on, obviously, and you know, any sane person would prefer a pie. Anyway, you know, that there's something been removed and then something being been put in its where it was. Mm-hmm. So that seems to me to be more of a contrast. Uh-huh. And I think that the contrast is more between Moses and Christ, or Moses and the Word and Jesus Christ, in that Moses came before, right? So what we would think is that the progenitor is greater than the successor. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be our default, mm-hmm. to think. So, you know, Jesus is a copy of a copy, if you will. Moses is 1.0, Jesus is 2.0, maybe he's an upgrade, but all the original genius is there with Moses, mm-hmm. right? And there's that contrast between Jesus and Moses throughout, as,
yeah.
you know, the Pharisees are like, you follow this guy, we follow Moses.
Right.
Right.
We are disciples of Moses. We right. don't know who you are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So there's really this very much a contrast, I think, between Moses and Jesus. Now, I don't think that John would take anything away from Moses. And I think that it's not for nothing that, so you're really talking about in verse 17. So out of his fullness, we have received grace in 16, grace in exchange in the place of grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Okay. So, first of all, this is bracketed by material about John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. John 1:15 says, John testified concerning him. This is the one about whom I spoke when I said, he who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. Mm-hmm. John the Baptist takes the place of the prophets of the Old Testament. He stands in for them in this exchange, in what we're being shown in these early, this earliest part. Mm-hmm. John is the fulfillment. He's really the culmination of the Old Testament, mm-hmm. right? He's somebody that's calling people to pure Judaism. As he goes out into the wilderness and really leaves the institutional forms of the Jewish religion to call people to genuine Judaism, okay? And the relationship between John and Jesus, it really is a pure reflection of what Moses, how Moses and Jesus would have been together.
Right, right, right. So John, the author, has a positive view of Moses.
Yes.
You're arguing in that mm-hmm. verse. And that was grace. It was a gift. The law, properly understood, is a gift from God.
Right.
Right. And then he's going to go on and show how it's misunderstood in the character of the Pharisees.
Right. Yes. But also, and again, remember, John is writing to not unbelievers, but believers. I know he says at the end, I've written this so that you may believe, mm-hmm. but this is an evangelist. This isn't an evangelistic work. It's a work to establish someone in their faith, a lot like the preamble of the book of Luke. I've written this so that you may know the certainty of the things that you've believed, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in an era of intense persecution, and we know that John was at the very beginning of this, of really intense in the late first century persecution, right? Under Domitian, I think. So, at any rate, so he's somebody that's like, you know, if you really under, it's okay to get up in the morning at 9 o'clock on Sunday and, you know, and go to church and wear your Sunday best and see all your friends and everything. You don't have to believe that much. Mm-hmm. Right? Remember, we said that the book of John, in the book of John, there's a spectrum of faith. Mm-hmm. John's readers were being called to the next level of faith.
Yeah.
You know, and so this book is written to usher them toward that because, you know, it's life and death, man. You know, this isn't just giving up an hour and a half on Sunday morning. This is everything, right? So we've got to be called to a deeper level of faith. And so at any rate, these people are familiar, I think, probably with some of the teachings of Paul and others, right? That this Christian body of work around Moses, because that's the biggest thing you have to deal with. You know, you've got this standing body of Yahwists, and you're trying to say, no, but we're like you, but we're inviting you to take the next level, right? Mm-hmm. To come up one level. Boy, that's an arrogant claim if you're not right. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, you know, you really want to get somebody to hate your guts. It's just a great way to do it. You know, go dabbling in their pond and then show them how you're better at what they're doing, mm-hmm. right? Man, that's you're picking a fight now, mm-hmm. right? So John is talking to people who've had to process this some already. And I think that they understand that the presence of a law, right? The existence of law suggests some sort of a formality to the relationship that needs to be removed.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, John is he really comes out hard on this notion that God has come in person.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, we talked about that earlier.
Right.
God is a fellowship, and he's inviting us into a fellowship, a
right.
relationship.
Right, and law has no place in that. Mm-hmm. You know, as much as we'd like to draw up a contract with our spouse and party the first part, party the second part, you know, the mm-hmm. purpose of that contract would always be, give me the limit at what I have to do for you. Mm-hmm. You know, always there. It's always in the background. You know, how little can I get by with and you still be happy, you still be here,
mm-hmm.
right? That's what a contract is, and that's what the law was. But the reason the law came through Moses is because Moses himself is a flawed human being. He's not the one who is in the bosom of the Father. He is not the one who's looked God in the face.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, so there's this contrast, right? Because right after it, he says, no one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is one with the Father, has made him known. So here you have a human being, Moses, who is clearly flawed. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in the record of Moses' life, here's somebody who's, you know, he's a violent guy. You know, he's somebody that God was going to kill on his way back to the mission because he'd kind of lived this dirty Gentile life out in the, you know, in Midian or wherever he was. And then so he's got some issues. Moses was a humble guy. Moses was a servant of God. But at the end of the day, he's a human. And because of that, you have two distinct parties. Two distinct species, races. You have humankind and God. So let's just take Russia and Putin, right? Let's say, you know, Trump and Putin are just fast friends. They're just best buds, you know. And Trump decides, you know, we're just going to give Russia most favorite status because Putin's my friend. Mm-hmm. How will that go over?
Very badly with at least half of the population.
Right.
And more than half, I would expect.
Right. So here you have really two armies at war, humankind and God and his hosts.
Yeah.
I mean, really, there's hostility. How do we form some sort of a connection in our mutual interest, but not ignore the fact that this hostility is still there, you know, or has been? The law was the way. Right. So that God is holy. Right.
Uh-huh.
Humans tend to forget that.
Mm-hmm.
So what does God do? He gives a law to manage the inherent enmity between humankind and himself.
Uh-huh.
Moses has never crossed beyond that meridian. You know, he's never crossed that 38th parallel. He's still on this side of it. You know, he's still somebody who can't look God in the face and live,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think that it's that the emphasis there is as much on Moses as it is on the law, that the law is a function of Moses, and Moses is the agent of the law, and it could never be otherwise. And so, you know, we ask, well, why did God even give the law, right? And Paul deals with this very, you know, extensively in this idea that, again, it's that childhood metaphor. It's that humankind is not to be trusted. And we see this in John at the end of John 2. Jesus is like, John says, he knew what was in people. People put their faith in him. He did not put his faith in them. Mm-hmm. There is an enmity. There is a hostility. Even the best humans, okay? Mm-hmm. Jesus, later we'll see in John 2, is at Passover, okay? So here's the high day. And he's in Jerusalem. Here's the best place. Mm-hmm. So if you're a Jew in Jerusalem on Passover, it's assumed that you're the cream of the cream, right? Of all humans on earth. So really you have, let's say you have the Gentiles, or let's say you have the barbarians out there, and then you have the Greeks, and then you have the people who are Jewish, but of the diaspora, and then you have the Judean Jews. But then you have the Judean Jews in Jerusalem at Passover, you know, in the temple. I mean, it's just, if you, it's a heat map, you know, this is just ruby red in this one little point, okay? And Jesus shows up and he kicks over tables and get out of here and, you know, you're a bunch of thieves. And it's like, what in the world? You know, if you're a Jew at that time and you've been comparing yourself to everybody else, and here you are at a lot of expense to yourself and trouble, you've come and you've held kosher. You know, you've cleaned everything you have. Mm-hmm. Burned stuff that couldn't be cleaned. You've traveled, or you've spent a ton on an animal to sacrifice. I mean, everything, you have paid for your religion. Okay, you're already on the outs. You're already weird, you know.
You've sacrificed.
But now you're so weird, mm-hmm. right? Now you're just doing something that's so expensive and so strange. And yet you're so close to your tradition, your history, this ancient relationship, your historical connection to God. And so it's a wonderful holy moment. And here comes this guy, you know, who just says, you're terrible. You're all terrible. You're all thieves, right? It's like, wow, what is wrong with you, man? You know, how can we get this right? But John's point, and really the point that recurs through the scripture, is that Jesus has a different origin point, and so he is unique. And that's what, you know, we've talked about this, and a lot of these repeat and they overlap, so forgive me for repeating them, but they bear it. You know, that the one, no one has seen God but the one who comes from God, right? And so someone comes to bear witness of God. Who can bear witness of God, really? Not somebody of this earth, because any theophany in this earth is going to be some sort of representation of God. It's not God in his full essence. Why? Because we'll die, you know? And so Moses got as close as anybody ever did. It seems apparent that that's the case because Moses' face was glowing. We don't hear that about anybody else, mm-hmm. you know? So whereas, let's say, Jacob was wrestling and encounters God face to face, right? Or Manoah and his wife, or others. But remember, we're told that this is the messenger of Yahweh. Well, in the Jacob story, we're told it's a man. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this isn't God in his essence. This isn't, you know, the eternal, invisible, you know, Holy One in his natural state, you know, his essential nature. It's a representation of him, right? Who, I mean, it's him, but, and I would contend it's Jesus, but at any rate, it's someone who comes to be the, who demonstrates the grace of God, which is his glory, but not in his, you know, in his actual essence, so that, you know, we would all just burst into flames, I suppose, mm-hmm. right? But so the contrast is that he has seen God in the face, mm-hmm. and this is what he's able to give. So as Moses goes up on a mountain, you know, Jesus comes from heaven.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So I would say that, and so my contention is that the grace and the place of grace already given is not speaking of that the grace previously given or the grace already given is not the Mosaic law. I would say that it is that there is a grace handshake from earth to heaven, where Jesus is the grace, offering the grace in exchange for grace. And I know that may be a leap. Okay, but remember, he doesn't say already given is added by the translators. Okay, mm-hmm. He says the law was given through Moses and
grace and truth
through Christ, right? And then he says of his fullness we've all received, and mm-hmm. grace for grace, mm-hmm. or grace in exchange for grace, mm-hmm. right? So trying to find where he says it, but we'll get there. At any rate, in Paul speaks of Jesus as offering this relationship of grace. Like in John 5, he talks about how the law of Moses was given to multiply trespasses, right?
And where is that at? You said John 5. You
meant something else. Romans 5. Romans 5. 12. Mm-hmm. And he says, but the gift, so he says, nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses. Mm-hmm. Okay. Even over those who did not sin by breaking a command as Adam did, who is a pattern of the one to come. But the gift is not like the trespass, for if the many died by the trespass of one man, mm-hmm. how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the many. Mm-hmm. So Moses is the agent of the law, which is the best a human can be, okay? Because humans don't have this entree, this inherent place with God. Mm-hmm. So what could Moses possibly do? Mm-hmm. He can only become the mediator. He cannot form the covenant. He can't bring the grace. You know, Moses and the Hebrew author of the Hebrew letter makes the distinction. He says that, you know, Moses was a servant in God's house, but how much greater is the house than the servant, right? Mm-hmm. So Jesus himself becomes the builder of God's house. It's not possible to show grace as the steward of the house. I'm only giving somebody else's resources, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas Jesus, being the owner of everything, can show grace because it's his. Mm-hmm. It's his to give.
Yeah.
And so it's just that Jesus is able to mediate, as it were, a better covenant because he has better resources. You know, that he can show grace. He can minister grace. Because he's full of grace. Mm-hmm. Moses can't be full of grace because he's a slave. You know, and this was understood in those days. A slave could never show grace, right? Because their lives are contingent. Everything that they have belongs to somebody else. Slaves are not gracious. They're only the recipients of grace. Unless a slave is adopted, mm-hmm. which Paul makes a big point of that in Galatians. Mm-hmm. So... all that to say, this is how it's all wrapped up into he came to his own, right? And his own, which really gets to this idea about the Judaism versus Christianity, the relationship of Jesus and the gospel to Judaism. You know, he came to his own didn't receive him. So there are two things there that are important. One is they're his own. You know, they're not the enemies, right? They're his. And they didn't receive him. It's also, they don't inherently belong to this because they've been given now a choice. Previously, they hadn't been. They were born into it. They were raised in it. Mm-hmm. There's an entitlement there, right? But now they have to make a decision. Now a decision is everything, really. Nobody gets to just be born in it. Everybody has to make the choice mm-hmm. now.
You must be born again.
You must.
Now, did I take us way off track, or is this what you wanted to talk about today?
Hey, well, yes, it is, but, you know, and again, this is probably going to be part one, just like in that other one, right. Just because there's so much. I mean, we really haven't gotten out of chapter one yet.
I mean, we are talking about Judaism.
We are.
But we're talking about it based on the scripture reference I brought up. I'm just, is this dovetailing with what you intended
to say? Of course. Yeah. I mean, what I intended would be kind of a far reach. You're assuming intention. I know it's there. We're going to discover it together. You know, we're just sifting through this field, you know, like digging through the diamond mine of the crater. We know the diamonds are there.
Yeah.
So let's just get them. And one of them is That at least my contention is that grace in place of grace is that that describes the covenant Jesus is able to mediate that Moses was not.
Okay.
Moses was not able to reach up with a grace handshake.
Okay.
Okay. But in doing that, in creating this grace bridge, you know,
Jesus
now,
is the grace bridge. Jesus right. reaches up with his grace. Mm-hmm. God reaches down with his grace. God
exactly.
the Father.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Right. So this gracious act on the part of a human who is the only one who ever had the means to show grace.
Uh-huh.
Why? Because he's the only one who belongs in heaven.
Jesus gave himself up on the cross.
Right.
That's grace.
Right.
He's giving himself to us.
Right, right. Because he belongs in heaven. You know, it's not like he's gaining points by doing this, right? It's already his.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So grace is the emptying of himself. Grace is the giving of himself because he has all of the entree. He has the rights to everything. You have to have the rights to everything to show grace.
Mm-hmm.
What human has that? This is the contention throughout the book of John. Who deserves to ascend besides the one who came down, right? And so Jesus, as the Word become flesh, is the only one who could possibly build this grace bridge, right? He's the only one who can possibly become the human agent of a covenant of grace by his nature as the Word, right? So that's the distinction. That's what John is. That's why John has been unloading so much about Jesus' pre-existence, right, as the Word, okay, as the one who comes down, because he's setting us up for this idea that the best a human agent could be is the giver of a law, right? Is just somebody who's passing on words that were given to him, yeah. right? And that's all really any of us aspire to, you know. Again, a prophet will come, someone will claim to be a prophet, and they're just saying, "Well, I'm just passing on some words," and that's really all a lot of us do, right? But what Jesus is given is a covenant where we can be, and we'll talk about that, but we can be this embodiment of God, right? So that we can be ministers of grace.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because we're sons of God. Why? Because because we're born from above, right? Because we're recipients of this grace along this grace bridge. And as now recipients of the grace and adoptees into the household and all of that, so we're able now to be ministers of this grace as well. It's an insane enterprise. You know, only one person throughout history until this point was ever able to be an agent of grace, really. And now, here's a whole species of people, you know, who can do this.
Yeah.
This is crazy. So John isn't just putting Jesus above Moses. He's putting everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jesus said in the Synoptics about John, I think around Matthew 11 is one reference. You know, Jesus is like, who'd you go out in the wilderness to see? You know, was it a reed shaken by the wind? Was it someone in fine clothes? He says, I tell you that of everyone born of woman, John is the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But he who's least in the kingdom is greater than he.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I look at my life, my ordinary life and working and keeping up with responsibilities and, you know, watching TV and falling asleep and doing it again the next day, as opposed to somebody who's living out in the wilderness eating grasshoppers, I'm like, well, you know, Jesus, I think it might have been a little hyperbolic there. But what I have are the resources to really defy the fear of death, to give with true generosity without, you know, any concern over, well, maybe coming back, you know, that I have a set of resources that John, even John the Baptist, didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John himself's like, okay,
yeah,
you know, I'm doing all this to see the kingdom, and where is it, dude? You know, I mean, he's stumbling, he's struggling. He doesn't have what Jesus has given to everyone who's his follower.
Yeah.
Right? And so, at any rate, but this relationship is... And Paul makes the point, you know, the law was important. It's critical. I mean, God didn't give it for nothing, right? And at the same time, it is surpassed. So just as John, who I think is speaking on behalf of all of the people in the Old Testament, the prophets and Moses, you know, he's after me, but he's before me, you know? And so I think that's the contention. Is it just as John had a role to fill, just as he had this ministry, right? And that it was orchestrated by God, right? John says he comes as a witness to the light. Jesus says he's a lamp shining and you were happy to bask in his light, right? So that's not nothing.
Right.
Right? But it's not everything, you know? It's not the full light of day. It's not the sunshine. And so, but when the day, you know, when the day dawns, do we still need the lantern? Should we keep oil in it and, you know, keep it up? I mean, you can't even really tell that it's, back in those days, especially where you had a candle or a lantern, you wouldn't even know it was on, you know, that it was lit.
Yeah.
And so that's, again, another metaphor, I guess, to this relationship between the coming of Christ. And that's the truth of the grace and truth. You know, it says the law was given through Moses. Grace was given through Christ. The truth is that all of these little lights are reflections.
Of the reality.
Right. And Jesus becomes the reality, right? The full light of day. The nature of things, all things. God and creation, our purpose, where we come from, where we're going, which is what Jesus says is really that's what it means to know. You know, to know where you come from, to know where you're going. Maybe that should be an evangelistic presentation, right? As we go out and we say, you know, what's this about, right? Where, you know, how did we get here? You know, and where's all this headed? I think everybody has their idea about it. And certainly how did we get here has a lot to do with where's it all headed, you know? I think that would be a really good way to just have a conversation. I talked with a friend about that, you know, just he's really wanting to know how to evangelize and stuff, which I'm not the person to come to for that. But I do think that listening to somebody, and I get this from, you know, Steve Timmis and Tim Chester and their book, Everyday Church. They talk a lot about evangelism in terms of using this gospel overlay, you know, kind of those four pillars of the redemptive arc, you know, creation, the fall, redemption, and consummation as a way. And they say everybody has those features to their worldview. You know, so Jesus is roughly saying the same thing, you know, throughout the Gospel of John. And so I did go far afield from Jesus' relationship to the scriptures, the Old Testament. But I think one, and to not just the Old Testament, but to Judaism specifically, I think maybe one point to broach, and then we'll explore it a little and then maybe pick up with it next time, is this statement that, you know, he came to his own, right? And we said this, and his own didn't receive him, right? In 1:11, he came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. And so there's, and the question becomes, and I'm sure that this had to have been, you know, throughout the first century, the hot button topic is, why do these Jews hate us? You know, and maybe we still wonder that today, you know. Judaism.
Why do the Jews not believe? Why do they reject Jesus and Christianity? Okay.
Right. So, and so John in his gospel, he's depicting Jesus interacting, and as he calls them, the Jews. Right. So I'm just going to honor his language. I'm not trying to be anti-Semitic.
Right, sure.
But I'm saying that there is for Jesus, there were Jewish people who were also Israelites. And then there were Jewish people who were the scribes and the Pharisees.
And when you call them Israelites, you're sort of alluding to, is it Nathaniel? He says, an Israelite indeed. So he's like really affirming Nathaniel.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And what, you know, the special feature about Nathaniel was that he was guileless. He, in whom was no guile or trickery or deceit. And in our little church, we talked about this on Sunday, that the arc of Israel, the man, right, his life, he didn't start out with that name. He started out with the name that meant trickster, right, deceiver. And he kept that and really lived it out, you know, for pretty much his whole life, right, until he gets to this moment where he wrestles with this man overnight, or probably in the wee hours of the morning till daybreak. And so this man accosts him and all that. Wrestle. I'm not going to let go unless you bless me. Right. And the man says, what's your name? really calls him to, anyway, what would it be like, you know, if your, you know, if your parents named you, you know, something embarrassing or weird or whatever, you know, and so like, let's say your parents were real hippies, right? And they named you something like Moon or, mm-hmm. you know, and now you have to tell the backstory or whatever, right? Yeah. Every time somebody says, what's your name? You have this moment of just
Yeah, my parents admission. Were hippies, you know.
Yeah, right, yeah, 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 yeah. It's almost like you have to tell your whole story in that, you know, every time. And it's probably laborious and a bit, I don't know, invalidating, diminishing, have to say this every time, right? And so, you know, this entity that he's wrestling with, this man, he says, what's your name? And he says, Jacob, right? Just has to have been embarrassing. Uh-huh. And instead of, you know, pleased to meet you, I am, they don't have that exchange. He says, you're not Jacob anymore. You're now Israel. Right. And I guess this is the blessing, right? And he says, because you struggled with people and with God and you have prevailed. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, from that moment on, we get the record of one more lie that Jacob tells. And that is, he tells Esau, I'm going to follow you back to Seir. But he doesn't. He doesn't have any intention to do that. But in that lie, he's only trying to spare Esau in his incumbence toward hospitality. Whereas Jacob realizes, hey, I've got all this, you know, this is going to be a burden. And Esau doesn't seem to have had a problem with that. You know, every other time that Jacob pulled his shenanigans, Esau basically, you know, he did want to kill him, right? Yep. But in this, you know, the next episode we see between Jacob and his brother Esau is that they're there to bury Isaac. Mm-hmm. You know, they come together as brothers in their common grief. And so there obviously was no hard feeling when Jacob doesn't show up. Esau probably knew Jacob wasn't coming. He didn't expect him. He wasn't like looking over the rise for him. He knew. So all that to say is that's the last time that we ever see Jacob pull anything on anybody. As a matter of fact, when the family goes to Pharaoh and they go to buy grain and they find out that their silver's back in their sacks, they're like, oh no, you know, and Jacob puts twice as much silver in the sacks and sends it. Previously, it would have been like, score.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but he's without that. That was extracted from him in that moment. You know, in this very low point when he's declared the winner, mm-hmm. now crippled, broken, facing sure destruction, mm-hmm. he's declared the winner, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And that, from that moment on, really, and, you know, even the story of Esau receiving him, it's identical to the prodigal. He saw him in the distance. He ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. Mm-hmm. Grace, you know, mm-hmm. grace as far as humans can do it, right? And he says, now that you've welcomed me, it's like seeing the face of God. He says to Esau. Esau becomes the agent of this, right? How mm-hmm. ironic. At any rate, and now you see the value, right? We all see the value of the Old Testament, mm-hmm. and the Jesus is there. But all that to say is so when Jesus points to Nathanael, and he says, this is a true Israelite, one in whom is no deceit. You think about that. How many people do you know that you would say, you know what they're thinking? Do you know who they are? You know, they don't have a secret agenda. They don't flatter. You know, they don't gild the lily. They just shoot straight. You know, they just tell it like it is. Consequences be darned.
Mm-hmm.
How many people are like that in the world, mm-hmm. right? Not many. and apart from, I think, a faith in God, probably no one, because no one can afford to.
Mm-hmm.
So this becomes a hallmark of an Israelite. Whereas you see people who, you know, who happen to be a part of the Jewish system who seem to have a secret agenda throughout the rest, right? They're plotting to kill him. You know, I mean, the very next chapter, in chapter 2, like we said, Jesus goes, he cleans house, literally, and then it says he doesn't trust any of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's not very many, you know, people like Nathanael, and yet this is somebody who's living out the purpose of it, right? The lesson that we should have gotten from the stories that the law should have trained them to become. Right? To do things because of a higher truth, not because of the convenience of the moment. right? That makes somebody guileless. Like if somebody truly is rooted in a belief in a supernatural, in a relationship with a supernatural being who has expectations of them, right? They're not going to try to find ways to trick somebody into making a deal that's going to be a bad one for them. Mm-hmm. You remember in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees, you can't enter the kingdom of God. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on and he talks about all these ways, these teachings of the Pharisees. And one is that if you swear by the, the altar, it's nothing. But if you swear by the gold and the altar, now you're bound. If you swear by the temple, it's nothing. If you swear by the one who lives in the temple, you're bound, mm-hmm. right? So here are people who've created non-binding oaths that appear to be binding. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's that for, right?
Well, that's for deception and manipulation.
Right, yeah. Right. Especially because if you're dealing with someone who's not a Pharisee and they're not aware of all these rabbinic, minutia, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you have an advantage over them.
Right.
They're Jew.
You can break your commitment. They can complain you broke the commitment. Then you can explain, but I didn't because it was a non-binding commitment.
Right, right. So they've avoided it. Now, does that sound like somebody who's a true Israelite?
Right.
That sounds like someone who's following Jacob, right? The way of the trickster, the deceiver. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so they've missed the point.
Yeah.
If you want to find a loophole to trade your wife in for a younger model, mm-hmm. Are you someone in whom is no guile? Are you a true Israelite, or are you somebody who's just using this little clause in Deuteronomy 22 for your own lust, right? Here's somebody who's claiming to be religious, right? They're going through all the steps, mm-hmm. and here they are just devastating somebody that they promised to love. Mm-hmm. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. Where do you get this? Mm-hmm. So all that to say, Jesus really made this distinction for what a true Israelite is. And then we see the dynamics, I guess, that created the Jew. Okay. Not again, I don't have a better way to say it, but somebody who is part of this cultural, institutional, racial movement, as opposed to somebody who's a true devotee and a worshiper mm-hmm. of God.
Yeah, a true child of Abraham.
Right, right. And so
someone who fears God and trusts God and obeys God.
Right. And, the Jews are no different from anybody else. That these social, psychological dynamics affect every person on the planet, and that it really takes some intention to avoid those, okay? Mm-hmm. So tribalism is not unique to Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. Nor is deceit or manipulation, right?
Right.
Jacob, right?
Right.
This is human nature.
Right, right. But nor are they immune from it because they have a religious system. The system itself gets co-opted into these negative mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. And so the temple, instead of becoming a place to commune with God, becomes a place to exclude other people. Mm-hmm. It becomes a place of control and power, where those who are over the temple now have control over everybody who would come to the temple. And so there is a real theft going on. Jesus calls them thieves, but they're stealing really from God. They're stealing his glory. They're stealing his power. And so that is, but yet again, that's human dynamics. I think the book of Hosea, this is going to be a little far afield, but I want to just point out that Hosea, a lot of times we read it because we have this romantic notion about the gospel, and that Hosea is about God taking Israel back like Hosea is supposed to take Gomer. And that God's long suffering, his love, his patience, his willingness to forgive, his redemptive love to bring his bride to himself. And that's what Hosea is about. It's not what it's about. Okay. Gomer, as far as we know, is never redeemed, right? She's still living out her ways. And being received by Hosea again just seems to enable her. Okay. So the point isn't redemptive love or unconditional love to a wayward spouse. That's not the point of Hosea. The point of Hosea is, how do you build a household when you have illegitimate children under your roof?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And God deals with that. So the illegitimate children under God's roof, under in Hosea, appear to be this polluted, syncretized religious system and political system. Okay, that the priests and the kings are the villains in a way. They're the, you know, Lo-Ami and you know, they're the kind of the product of this history with Moses and this revelation at Sinai and the political forces around them. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the interpersonal power dynamics in religion. And so they create illegitimate children, right? And we do this all the time, you know. We take some revelation from God and we bastardize it, mm-hmm. right? So what is God going to do? God says, I'm going to take away her vineyard. And by that, he means the walled city of Jerusalem. And I'm going to call her out into the wilderness, and she will love me again as she did at the first. Okay? And this is in chapter 2. So the idea is, how do you get rid of the illegitimate children in the house? You burn the house down and start over, you know? And so that's kind of what he's going to do, and that's what Jesus calls him to do, right? Is to just come out into the wilderness. And just John the Baptist prefigures that,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, he goes to the wilderness.
Right.
He calls Israel to come out to the Jordan to be baptized.
Exactly. And
for the repentance.
Right. Yeah. And next time we'll talk more about how this is prefigured in the prophets, you know, how this is all going to play together into God's one purpose, and that is to have this union with his people, you know, that he calls a marriage. Right. So
next time, people, did you hear that? Next time. Thanks for being with us this time. If you got questions, you can email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. And have a great week. We'll see you next time.